Hey, this is Scott Ian, the rhythm guitar player from Anthrax. Yep, it's me. And stay tuned to hear me talk a whole bunch of more crap with my buddy Nate Goyer on The Vinyl Guide.
Well, thanks, Scott. And hey, everyone, thanks for tuning into this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast where we talk to the artists behind the records we love and collect. And this week, metalheads rejoice, we have Scott Ian of Anthrax here on the show. Now, Scott, as you know, is a guitarist of the legendary Big Four thrash metal band Anthrax. And today we catch him all jet laggy in his hotel room. We talk music, guitar heroes, spoken word touring, beard care products, and much, much more with the legend himself. And this week's episode is a bit of a doubleheader. We also talk to audio restoration engineer Sean Franklin, who's proud as can be of the Anthrax State of Euphoria 30-year reissue about to hit the streets. Limited edition vinyl runs are available and orderable at anthrax.com. Oh, and by the way, Aussies, Scott is in Australia this week, and he is doing a spoken word tour. And guess what, people? The Vinyl Guide and me, your buddy Nate, we can help you see Scott live. Yes, that's right. I have links in this episode page with a discount code if you want to see any of the shows in Adelaide, Melbourne, Sydney, or Brisbane. Just simply go to thevinylguide.com or facebook.com/vinylguide for the special links and discount codes. And with that, let's start this week's episode featuring Scott Ian of Anthrax.
Do you listen to and collect vinyl records? Well, you're in luck. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast made for record nerds like yourself. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
All righty, here we go. Testing 1, 2. We are back this week. Hey, everyone, it's Nate, host of The Vinyl Guide. Thanks for downloading. Thanks for listening. Thanks, everyone, who's sharing and telling their friends about this podcast. Wow, this is a huge week for us. Not only do we have Scott Ian of Anthrax on today's show, we also have discount codes for his spoken word performances this week in Australia. So listen up. If you are in Adelaide, Melbourne, Sydney, or Brisbane, and you want to see Scott Ian's spoken word live, here's your chance. I've got discount codes for Vinyl Guide listeners on our episode page at thevinylguide.com or on facebook.com/vinylguide. Get over to them and enjoy the show. And in other Anthrax-related news, the band is currently in the process of reissuing their album State of Euphoria. It's a 30-year anniversary commemoration box set, complete with a whole ton of extras, lost tapes, outtakes, that sort of thing, and totally remastered for vinyl. And today, for that, we are going to talk to Sean Franklin. Now, Sean, you may remember, he's been on the show. He's a friend of ours. He's an audio restoration engineer, and he specializes in taking old tapes and creating packages and box sets, really creating a historical story and package around some of these legendary albums. And today, Sean is going to talk with us on how he developed the State of Euphoria project with Charlie Benante and Team Anthrax. And I got to tell you, the whole package looks really amazing. It's very thorough. You'll hear Sean talk about it today. It's going to be after our interview with Scott. And you could also go to anthrax.com and check out the whole package for yourself, complete with special limited edition colored vinyl reissues at anthrax.com. And when you finally get that State of Euphoria vinyl reissue in your hands, you're going to need something to clean it with. God only knows where that record came from or who's been touching it. And that is why you need a Groove Washer record cleaning kit. Groove Washer is the biggest bang for your record cleaning buck. And they have record cleaning kits starting at just $12. But Groove Washer isn't all about record cleaners. GrooveWasher.com has a heap of accessories for the vinyl maniac on your Christmas list or even the one behind your eyeballs. Groove Washer has record stabilizer weights, awesome platter mats, stylus cleaning brushes, heaps more. Plus, you get a discount code from The Vinyl Guide. 10% off from your buddy Nate on anything you buy from GrooveWasher.com. The checkout code is VinylGuide10. You get 10% off, and this was made especially for the international listeners of this show. It helps offset the cost of shipping. So go to GrooveWasher.com. Fill up your shopping cart full of awesome vinyl record accessories. Use code VinylGuide10 and you'll get 10% off everything at GrooveWasher.com. All right, so just a few things to share before we start today's interviews with Scott and Sean. First off, Scott is not involved in the whole vinyl record production of Anthrax. He really doesn't seem very interested in it at all, in fact, so we really didn't talk about vinyl records. By the way, this is ground we covered pretty thoroughly in our episode with Charlie Benante, episode number 99 of The Vinyl Guide. Now, we also had a bit more time with Charlie. Today's interview with Scott had to be quick. He just landed. He was on a bit of a schedule, so we had to jump around a bit to try to cover it all. But we have Sean Franklin on to talk about the vinyl aspects of Anthrax and the State of Euphoria reissue. So stay tuned for that. That's going to be right after our discussion with Scott. Now, also to note is the phone connection with Scott could sound a bit distorted at times throughout the interview. As we were doing sound tests before the interview, we determined there was a bad hotel phone, but can't do much about it. He wasn't going to switch rooms just for a 30-minute interview. So you could still hear every word, but it distorts here and there, and it could be a bit annoying. So thanks in advance for your patience. And lastly, speaking of annoying, Scott was very jet-lagged and likely not in the best of moods. Certainly not to get rapid-fire Q&A from some idiot in Australia over a distorted hotel phone. You guys remember our episode with Vernon Reed of Living Color? Yeah, same kind of thing there. In fact, there's one part of the interview where you could noticeably feel Scott's attitude turn. It's when we're talking about his spoken word performances, and he seems to get pretty agitated. So to be clear, I do not know a thing about what it's like to be standing up in front of tens of thousands of people playing guitar. But I do know what it's like to stand up in front of a room or a hall full of drunk Australians with nothing but a microphone and trying to hold their attention. So it ain't easy. So I hope he fares well over the next week of shows. If you are in Australia, Mr. or Mrs. Listener, Scott has got shows in Adelaide, Melbourne, Sydney, and Brisbane. And I've got some discount codes that you could use to get yourself in, watch the show, ask Scott questions, and hell, you may enjoy some of that old Scott Ian attitude aimed at you as well. So go to thevinylguide.com or facebook.com/vinylguide, get the discount code, and get your tickets now. All right, let's get this show rolling. By the way, don't forget the Sean Franklin interview on the State of Euphoria 30-year anniversary reissue is right after our conversation with Scott, so stay tuned. And here we go. Without further ado, let's start the chat with Scott Ian of Anthrax. On the Vinyl Guide, we are stoked we have on the show music and metal guitar legend Scott Ian, who is actually down in my neck of the woods this week. Scott, welcome to Australia. How are you finding it so far?
Extremely jet laggy.
It'll do that to you. So you've got quite a schedule over the next week and a half. I believe you're doing Comic-Cons and then a spoken word tour, yeah?
Yeah. I start tonight with Brisbane Comic-Con, and it's going to be a really busy week, but it's all really fun stuff that I enjoy doing. I love going to Comic-Cons, and I love doing my talking shows, so I wouldn't be here if I wasn't going to have fun doing it. So I'm really excited that I even have the opportunity to come to Australia and do this.
I do want to talk about your spoken word tour, and I'm curious as what you do at Comic-Cons. Is that spoken word as well?
No. Comic-Con is more just hanging out, and people come and they take pictures and they get stuff signed, and it's kind of like a giant meet and greet.
Does anyone ever like walk past you and go, "Oh, that's a cool Scott Ian cosplay"?
No, but that not specifically at Comic-Con. No, but I can tell you that many times I've had people walk up to me and say, "You know, you look just like that guy from Anthrax." And I'll just kind of go, I know I get that a lot, and then go on my merry way.
Oh, that's awesome. So, Scott, we're so glad to have you down under. And again, I do want to talk about the spoken word tour. But first, I want to go back a little bit. Let's talk about the music. Back when you were a youngster, back in New York, when did you become aware that you had a real connection with music?
I don't know. There was always music in my house growing up. My parents listened to music all the time. They were always playing records, or and the radio was always on in the car. So it was just something it was just a part of my life because my parents listened to music. So, you know, from an early age, whether it was hearing the Beatles on the radio and my mom loving stuff like Bob Dylan and Elvis, and my dad being into Simon and Garfunkel, and later on stuff like the Doobie Brothers, and they loved the Band. And so there was just always music. Elton John was another, you know, early 70s when Elton John, you know, started to get big in the States. You couldn't, you know, not hear Elton John. He was on the radio constantly, and my parents had records in the house. And so it was just always around me. So it was just kind of normal for me. It wasn't a case of becoming aware of it. It was just always there.
Yeah. You didn't know a world without it, it sounds like.
Exactly. Yeah.
I know you're a huge Kiss fan. You discovered them early in life, obviously. Did your parents still follow you along with that journey with Kiss, or is that where you started kind of separating in taste?
No, Kiss was the first thing that was mine. Because I liked pretty much everything my parents were listening to. I can't say that there was anything I disliked. But then, you know, from Elton John, really, because I really, really got into Elton John. It was kind of more like that spoke to me more than everything else that they were listening to. And from Elton John, it wasn't a long leap to Rock and Roll All Night. You know, something like Saturday Night's All Right for Fighting, which I love that song so much. And then I hear Rock and Roll All Night on the radio, and it was kind of just like, wow, what's this? And then, of course, when I saw what Kiss looked like, that just sealed the deal. But my parents were not into it. It just wasn't for them in any way, shape, or form.
Mm-hmm. Were you a comic book kid, too? I mean, was that something?
Oh, yeah, comic books, horror movies, sci-fi, I mean, all of that since I could read and watch TV.
And in your autobiography, I'm the Man, you tell a lot of stories about this time, so we won't go too deep into it. But one of the things you started talking about was wandering the streets of Manhattan at age 13. Now, was that musically driven? Like, what was happening around this time to where you were actually taking the train into the city and pretty much unwatched or unaccompanied by a parent?
Yeah, you know, I think about that stuff, and because I have a son, and when I think about that in the context of me having a child, and I just don't see how I was ever able to be allowed to take a train into the city myself with my friends at the ripe old age of 13. And, you know, you're talking about the Manhattan of movies like Taxi Driver. It's not the Disneyland Manhattan that exists now. This was 1977. When I started going into the city by myself, not by myself, but with my friends, you know, on the weekends and to see shows you know, it seemed completely normal. I never felt like I was in danger. I never felt worried about it. We kind of knew, I guess we had enough street smarts, you know, at that age to understand how to hang out. on our own. And it was definitely musically driven because it started with the ability to be able to go to shows without parental supervision. And that, you know, turned into, well, we're just going to go hang out in Greenwich Village, you know, on a Saturday. There's no school. Can we take the train in and go hang out in the village? Because there was great record stores and great T-shirt stores and stores that sold posters and buttons and pins and, you know, all kinds of paraphernalia, whether it was stuff to get high or just rock related stuff. Go down and just look at magazines on the newsstands, you know, and sit there and read Cream magazine for an hour. It was all music related.
How did you discover punk rock?
Well, the Ramones were from about 5 miles away from where I grew up. So, and the Ramones were on television. I saw the Ramones on the Sha-na-na variety show as a kid. And, you know, that was a big TV show. And then I found out through probably Cream or a magazine like Rock Scene that the Ramones were from Queens. And that just made it all seem so possible to me that a bunch of dudes in Levi's and leather jackets could make records and be on TV, because Kiss didn't seem possible at all. But the Ramones seemed very possible. And I guess that was the initial attraction. I did like the music as well. But the idea that you didn't have to look like, the idea that you didn't have to look like Kiss to make it, so to speak, was very attractive to me too, because I looked like the guys in the Ramones. They were older than me, but I dressed exactly like they did. And it just opened up a world of possibilities for me. You know, the whole DIY idea of punk rock, it was very attractive to me.
Yeah, you didn't have to look like Kiss or have that production, and you didn't have to play like Emerson, Lake, and Palmer.
No, but and it didn't take away from how much I loved Kiss or other bands too. But, you know, the Ramones certainly opened the door. It wasn't until much later that I actually started going to hardcore shows at CBGB's. That wasn't until like late 83 or early 84. I didn't even know that world existed, like, to be able to go. At 13, that was way over my head. I went out and started buying Ramones records, and then, of course, found out about the Sex Pistols and the Clash and all that. But going to shows or going to punk clubs wasn't something I did till I was much older.
So jumping ahead here in the East Coast thrash scene, what was it like in those days? Because it seems like the thrash scene was largely on the West Coast. Were you a bit of an isolated band? Was there a very rich community there in terms of thrash music, hardcore music?
There was nothing. We didn't know anything. There was no way to know, really, and not in the early days. By 83, because of Johnny Z and his record store and through tape trading and all that kind of stuff, we were able to start finding out about stuff that was going on around the planet. But in 81 and 82, no, we didn't know anything. We didn't know about any other bands, not in our area. We knew about bands from other countries and stuff, but there was nothing, as far as we knew, there was nothing going on in New York City for metal at all. We knew there was a punk scene, but there was no metal scene. Nobody doing original music, certainly. We couldn't get a gig. Any gig we would try to get at any real club, they would just tell us to go learn a Van Halen cover set and, you know, come back. And, you know, there was this, we didn't know about anything. You know, and we weren't wrong either, thinking that there was nothing going on, because, years later, we found out the only other band even similar to what we were doing was Overkill from New Jersey. And that might as well have been 3,000 miles away, as far as we knew then, because they were doing stuff out where they were in New Jersey, and we were trying to do stuff in Queens and Manhattan and Brooklyn. And, you know, it wasn't until 83 and 84 when we started playing shows at Lemoore's in Brooklyn. That's when you find out, oh, there was another band kind of doing a similar type thing as us. But that was it. There was nothing going on. There was zero metal scene at that point.
Mm. Was there a really strong competition between the bands, or was there a camaraderie just because there were so few of you? Well, like you said, when you started playing Lemoore's and that sort of thing, was it a tight community, or did?
Everybody was friends.
Were you aware of the Misfits or any of the New Jersey punk?
Sure, but again, different world. Mm-hmm. We had nothing to do with the punk scene at all.
This is a time where the punk scene was very, I guess, defensive in terms of allowing people in the metal scene to come in. How did you fuse that gap?
I really just got tired of missing shows that I wanted to see. And my friend Robert, who, you know, was into a lot of the same music as I was, we really wanted to go see Agnostic Front at CBGB's. And basically just decided, we're just going to do it. Screw it. If we get there and people want to kick our asses, we'll just run away. it's, you know, we'll just get the hell out of there as fast as we can. And we decided to finally go see a show, and we ended up getting embraced by that scene immediately from that first show. So, but it wasn't a lie. It just so happened that it was a guy named Billy Milano who came over to us, who of course went on to be the singer of SOD years later. But at that first Agnostic Front show, he walked up to me basically and said, "Aren't you the guy from Anthrax?" and introduced himself. And he was playing bass in a band called the Psychos at the time. And he like brought us backstage to meet Agnostic Front. So, it wasn't untrue that long haired dudes or metal dudes would get beat up. That was very much a fact back then at that time. But because Billy kind of took us under his protection.
Almost, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then we met the Agnostic Front guys, and they were super cool. Then, you know, nobody messed with us after that. It was okay for us to come to shows.
It's always struck me that Anthrax has been these pioneers in fusing different styles of music. I mean, starting with punk and metal, then rap and metal. Why do you think initially there's a reluctance in the music scene to combine styles? And what do you credit for driving Anthrax to taking those risks?
I don't think about. We just did what we did. You're influenced by things, and things come out in what you do. That's about as much as I've ever analyzed it.
In terms of, you know, going back into the early days here, Fistful of Metal, Charlie was on the show a couple months ago, and we talked about the cover art. Why do you think all those thrash metal album covers look ridiculous? The first releases, Kill 'Em All, Exodus Bonded by Blood. Well, what do you think that is?
Well, I think there's a lot of reasons. One being, there was no money. There was no budget for art. You were lucky if you knew somebody who could possibly do art for your cover, you know, a friend or whatever. There was just no money to do anything. And there wasn't a very clear, strong artistic vision, I think, on, certainly for us, what the fuck did we know? It was 1983 when we were making that record. I was all of 19 years old. I knew what I liked. I knew I loved Iron Maiden album covers. I knew what I liked on other people's record covers, but we really had no idea what to do. There was another early idea for that cover that Neil, because basically we were kind of at the whims of what Neil, the original singer, wanted. It was he did. I give him credit for the fact that he had he had a vision. He had ideas. It was more than I could say for me at the time. I had no idea what I wanted on the cover. We have a song on that record called Death From Above, and there was an early idea of having like a jet fighter pilot, like a close-up of a fighter pilot helmet, I think maybe we all thought it looked too much like Black Sabbath, Never Say Die or something. I don't remember. But then he had the Fistful of Metal idea, which became the album cover, and which we all agreed on and thought, yeah, this could be really cool. But then the guy that actually did that painting just didn't really realize the idea, I think, as well as we hoped. That's all, because that's the best he could do at the time. And it's, you know, it's one of those things that is, I like to think it's so bad it's good kind of things after all this time.
It's like a puzzle looking at it and just trying to figure out what's going on.
Yeah, it's a mess. It's a fucking mess. But you know what? It definitely represented the record at the time.
Yeah, yeah. Like I said, it's a good lesson to learn early, you know, and helps you kind of tighten up your processes a bit on that. So jumping forward a bit here, Among the Living, Eddie Kramer was in the picture, and you mentioned in your book he was trying to make Anthrax sound like Def Leppard. Did any mixes happen that way? Is there a chance of hearing a version at some point of Among the Living that sounds like Hysteria?
I don't know. I don't think anything exists, because we obviously didn't like it when we walked in and heard where he was going with whatever song he was mixing first. And he, you know, we ended up basically with what we wanted after telling him, this isn't what we want. You need to pull all of this reverb and all of these delays and all this. We want it just really dry and in your face, and he didn't want that. And we got in a big argument, but look, it's our record, and that's the way it had to be. And he said, come back in a couple hours again, and then we came back, and I think out of spite, he just literally pulled every possible delay and reverb and any bit of air that he might have used on anything. It was just completely dry as a bone, and we actually liked it.
That's what you wanted.
And we're like, well, you could put something on the vocals or on the this or that, and then he saw how excited we got by the way it sounded, and I think you know, that kind of helped his attitude towards it, because he saw how excited we were, and it did sound great. So, but no, I don't think that it exists, because, you know, he did this mix that we hated, and then he pulled it all apart. So it's not like we ever even took a tape out of there with one of those mixes.
When it comes to State of Euphoria, and I believe you and Charlie, others in the band have commented that State of Euphoria is the one album that you wish you had more time with. It was rushed. You're now having a 30-year anniversary version of that record. I believe Sean Franklin's mixed it up and it's getting ready to come out. What surprised you most about going through this reissue? Do you think that this is going to help correct some of the wincing moments that you had from the original mix?
No, because it has nothing to do with the mix. For me, it's the songwriting. I don't think half the songs on that record are finished. It's well documented. It's not like a secret. We didn't spend enough time writing half of that record, because we had to get on tour with Iron Maiden in the summer of '88, so we had to be done. And I just feel like some of those songs to me aren't finished versions. They're not what they could have been if we would have spent more time working on them. So no, changing a mix or remastering it's not going to fix anything for me.
Right.
I love half the record, and I don't love half the record. And, you know, it's not like we're ever going to spend the time to rewrite those songs. So, it is what it is.
You would never go back and see if you could try to realize that vision, like Best of Both Worlds or anything like that. You wouldn't go back. It's in the rearview mirror, clearly.
Yeah, I don't look backwards like that, no.
In doing this reissue, were there any surprises that came up from the tapes? Any tracks you totally forgot existed?
No. How could I forget?
Oh, well, outtakes and that sort of thing.
No, not really. No, it's almost like saying you forgot one of your children. Yeah.
Okay. So you're down under. You are in the land of AC/DC, and I know you're a big Malcolm Young fan. You even have a tat on your arm, yeah?
Yes.
So is he your guitar hero? Is he the guy that you...
He is. I mean, him and Angus both. Because I really learned how to play guitar. I mean, I already knew how to play guitar, but when I started listening to AC/DC records around 78, I guess, that's really how I learned how to play guitar, by just putting on Powerage and Highway to Hell and learning the chords to those songs and how they played those chords. And of course, Malcolm being the rhythm guy, I just kind of gravitated towards him. I can't say necessarily out of laziness, but for me, it was just a case of I loved learning the chords and learning how to play a whole song. And then I would try and learn the leads, but that took so much more time. And in the time it would take me to learn a lead, I could like learn five more songs. Like I could learn the chords of like the rest of the album. So it just kind of gravitated that way for me, because then I'd be able to go jam with my friends and go, look at all these songs I could play. And that's really where it came from. And, you know, I didn't know at the time that Malcolm Young was the greatest rhythm guitar player ever, because I wouldn't have known that then. But I understood that he was great because AC/DC were great, and his guitar tone was such a huge part of their sound, you know. And of course, years later, I found out, yeah, he was the main riff writer, and you just learn about why he was so great. And then I knew I was right for liking them in the first place. But, I love Malcolm. I love Malcolm. I love his brother. I love AC/DC. And I think I think I'm getting tattooed in Melbourne on Tuesday, while I'm down here, and it isn't, I'm not going to give away what it is, because I think they're going to do some kind of promotional thing around this, but It is an AC/DC related tattoo to go along with my Angus and Malcolm tattoos that I already have.
Oh, far out. And at Melbourne, of course, there's AC/DC Lane. I don't know if you've been there.
Well, I've been there, yeah. I've been to Cherry Bar in Melbourne a few times, and I've been there. I love it. You know, it's just so cool as a fan to just, I don't know, just stand there and, I don't know what it really means, but I like being there.
Yeah, it feels like a bit of history, especially growing up in the States, and AC/DC seems so far away. To be able to actually kind of bask in a bit of that air seems very special.
Sure. I mean, I've been there. I've visited Bond's grave, you know, on the West Coast, and yeah, it's just one of those things. It was just important for me to go do that.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you had to add two or three more bands into the Big Four to make it the Big Seven, who would you nominate to take those three spots?
I don't know. I'm not the mayor of heavy metal, so that's I don't know that I could answer that question.
You are now.
And or that you have to actually. I can't. That's above my pay grade. That you'd have to give that question to Metallica. I will say this. I would certainly put Exodus in there. Beyond that, I really don't know how to answer. Maybe Exodus for sure, because they were right there as far as American bands at that time playing thrash metal. So I don't know I don't know what the actual criteria is. Like, could you add European bands, or is it only American bands that were playing thrash at that time? You know what I mean? So there's a lot of criteria to think about before I just open my mouth haphazardly and say the wrong thing. But I will absolutely say I wish from the start it would have just been the Big Five, and Exodus should have just been involved from day one.
Jumping forward a bit, the cover of Stomp 442 was done by Storm Thurgeson. I believe it was originally designed for Bruce Dickinson Balls to Picasso. Is that correct? Or is that a rumor?
Not that I know of. Okay. No, I'm first time I'm ever hearing that.
Okay. Do you remember the source of the cover or the discussion around it before you saw it? Or?
Yeah, I remember him telling us he was going to go build this giant thing out of metal because there was no Photoshop yet. So he actually had to go build a giant section of it and then photograph it and then be able to piece those sections together to make it look like a sphere.
Ah, okay. All right. Yeah, there's the rumor has it that it was prepared originally for Bruce Dickinson's solo album, and then he couldn't afford it, so you guys got it. That was
that sounds wrong right away, because why would Bruce not be able to afford Storm and we could? That makes zero sense.
Okay. We've got some questions from our audience. James Ryan sent in a note. We wanted to know your thoughts on the Stomp 442 mix. Do you approve of the mix? Were you happy with it? Apparently, there was some discussion around the bass being low or lost in the mix.
excuse me. I love the mix on that record. Yeah, no problem. When we were working with the Butcher Brothers, they called it Steel Cage Match. They would say, more Steel Cage Match. Whatever that meant, and every time they said that, it sounded better to me.
Alrighty, there's the answer there. JCar80 asks, when the hell is Sound of White Noise going to get a repress?
You're asking the wrong guy. I don't know how any of that works, nor what labels are thinking or any of that, so I have no answer for that question.
Okay. All right, well, here's one you may have an answer for. Ed Kim asks, Scott, how long are you going to grow your beard?
What do you mean? Like, what age do I plan on shaving it?
No, are you going to go for, like, full ZZ Top? Are you going to hit it, your belt buckle? What do you think?
I don't do anything to it. This is what it does. I don't do anything. So if it grows longer, it grows longer. If it stays this length, it stays this length. I give it zero thought.
Do you put conditioner in it?
Sometimes.
When you want to treat yourself? Light some candles.
Again, not something I think about very often.
Okay. Apparently Ed does, though. Question for you. When touring with Public Enemy, were the crowds significantly different than the crowds Anthrax had before?
No. It was mostly a white male heavy metal audience. So no, definitely not that different than any other crowd we've had before.
Okay. All right. So it sounds like when you're touring with Public Enemy, it was mainly your crowd, but they were getting exposed to Public Enemy more.
No, they had their crowd too, but at the time, certainly. And, you know, this is from Chuck D's mouth, not mine, but they had, depending on who they were touring with, would kind of dictate what audience was going to be there for them. And they had just as big, if not a bigger, white audience than they did a black audience at that time. Because I said, what do you think it's going to be like? And he said, it's going to be 90% white people or more at these shows. So it was that's what it was.
Do you foresee yourself doing any further tours with Public Enemy?
I would love to.
In terms of the spoken word touring, it really sounds like it's the ultimate in light travel. There's no roadies, no setup. You don't even, I guess, need to bring a suitcase if you don't want to. How are you adjusting?
Well, you're forgetting about my entourage of 40 people that have to carry my beard conditioner and all of that.
Fair enough.
I can't go anywhere without my beard conditioner.
Yeah. Clap your hands and... Would you like some more spritz, Mr. Ian? Yes.
Yes.
So in terms of the spoken word environment, you prefer doing, is this kind of like the next phase of your career? You're looking to spend 50-50 with spoken word and Anthrax? What are your thoughts?
I don't have thoughts. I don't have thoughts. I got an opportunity to come down here and do this in this window of time a few months ago, and it just worked out, and I haven't given it no thought past this as to when I can or can't do another talking show. I love doing them, but I just don't have the ability to do it because I'm in Anthrax, and that's my band and that's my priority. So I really don't waste much time worrying or thinking about stuff that I just have no control over. Sometimes things happen that I'm able to take advantage of it, but you know, it's not like I'm looking for reasons to leave home. this just worked out really well.
When starting to do spoken word, did you have to learn any comedy techniques or skills and crowd control?
No, not that I know of. I just get on stage and I do my thing. I don't know that there's. I don't know. Well, first of all, I'm not a stand-up comedian. So, you know, I'm on stage telling stories. I don't write jokes or, you know, and get on stage and tell jokes. I'm telling stories from my life. It's a completely different thing. And I don't really know if there's a right or a wrong way about any of it. I just get on stage and I do what I do. And people seem to laugh in all the right places and or react in all the right places. So that's the only way I could judge, you know, whether or not I feel like I'm doing well or not, is because people are reacting in a positive way to what I'm doing. So, but as far as learning anything, no, I just get on stage and I do my thing.
Mm. Do you have hecklers or anything like that in the audience at any point?
No.
Okay. Look, being Scott Ian, I'm sure people enjoy hearing your stories and laughing with you, but it is a big change from going to, you know, a group of friends to being a crowd. Are you finding them equally polite?
I don't know what you mean. Why is there an expectation that people are going to come to my show and heckle me and not be polite? People are paying money to come be entertained. So what would be the point of coming to my show and heckling me? I don't really understand why there would automatically be an expectation that that would happen.
No, well, look, I'm interested because I used to do quite a bit of comedy, and we would have hecklers come up. Even if they paid, we would have people that would get drunk and, you know, want to become part of the show, and we'd have to almost...
No, I understand. I've been to 1,000 stand-up shows. I know what hecklers are, but it's not something I've had to deal with. Or maybe I'm just used to being on stage in front of drunk people, so it's not something that affects me. Honestly, I really don't give a shit what is, you know, I'm so focused on what I do, whether I'm on stage with Anthrax or doing my talking shows or whatever it is. You know, I'm so focused, I'm so in my world and in my zone. It would really take, you know, something very huge to kind of pull me out of that enough to then have to stop what I'm doing to interact with somebody else. You know, it's one thing like if at a show and the crowd is so crazy and the barricade gets broken and we have to stop playing. Like, that's a big deal. And you have to stop and obviously pay attention to that. But, you know, outside of something big like that, I'm in my zone. I get on stage and I'm, you know, I treat it like I'm on a sports team and I'm trying to win the game. And I'm just giving everything I have, every song, to make that happen. And it's the same when I'm talking to a crowd. I'm just so in my own zone and in my head, trying to entertain people as best I can with just me and a microphone, because I don't have my band there. So if people are heckling or, you know, maybe I'm not paying attention.
Uh-huh. Well, in the past, you've had a guitar that has in some ways been between you and the audience. It's something for you to do. But when it's just you with the microphone, has that been a strange transition or completely natural?
Not at all, because the microphone is a bigger thing to have between me and the audience, because it gives me the ability to have a really, really loud voice, louder than anybody else's, and everybody pay attention to me and what I'm saying. When I'm playing guitar, I don't have that power. That's why I have to work even harder, I feel like, sometimes to express myself, because I'm doing it with my guitar playing. Whereas it's much easier to express myself with words. You can really get your point across much quicker with words. And so having the microphone for me is the ultimate power tool on a stage.
Do you have a set list that you follow? Do you know what you're going to open with and close with, or do you just riff throughout?
I have a good idea. Yeah, I have a good idea what I'm going to open with and how I'm going to close the show, because you want to open strong, obviously. And I mean, I want the whole show to be strong, but I want to kind of, I want to hook people right up front and make them see, like, wow, I had no idea this is what this was going to be like. And, you know, really just try and hook them immediately and get them interested, get their curiosity piqued right from the start. And, of course, especially if they got too drunk, that's probably, they might only remember that. So yeah, of course. But the whole show is that way. There's no dull moments in this thing. I'm up there for 2 hours and more, and honestly, there's no time for me to rest, and there's really nothing dull going on. Everything, all the stories I may choose to tell are all just so inherently ridiculous and over the top. It's really kind of hard to not want to pay attention, because the stories are crazy. And I wouldn't be doing this if I didn't feel like I had the stories to hold people's attention, you know, for 2 hours. That's the last thing I would ever want to do, is just be standing on stage thinking, like, God, I'm boring the shit out of these people. Like, and I don't want to do that, obviously. And I've got the material that's the opposite of that.
Did you start off, when you started doing some of the talking shows, with a few clunkers, and you had to weed those out and workshop other things in there, or?
No, it started off good, and then I feel like it's only gotten better the more I've done it.
Is there much interaction with the crowd in terms of, do they ask questions, or is it pretty much you just telling stories one after the other?
I do a Q&A in the show to give them the opportunity to interact, and if, you know, they've had some question burning a hole in their brain for 25 years that they've always wanted to ask me, well, I give the floor over to them. And I've said it, you know, so many times, I'm not afraid of any question. If I can answer it, I'm going to. And if I can't answer it, it's not because I don't want to. It's probably literally because I just don't have an answer. But I totally give it over to them, and depending on how good the questions are and what tangents and what other roads they take me down as far as stories I'll tell based on those questions. I mean, the Q&A could go on a really long time. I've done shows that were over 3 hours because the Q&A section ended up being an hour long, because people just triggered other really good stories.
And it's like, you turn around, you're like, oh my God, 3 hours ago, and you didn't even feel like it.
It really flies by. It's amazing. The first time I ever did it, I talked for 2.5 hours, and I had no idea I'd been on stage that long. I asked someone after the fact. I was like, what was that, about an hour or 75 minutes? They're like, dude, you were on stage for 2.5 hours. And I just had so much fun, and it really just flew by.
Are any questions off limits? Like if someone asks you, okay, who's the biggest jerk you've ever played with in the band, or the worst band you've ever seen live, or that sort of thing? Are you open to
that? You know what? It depends on my mood. It depends how surly I'm feeling in the moment. I'm not going to answer those questions sometimes, just based on the fact that, look, you know, I'm not a shit talker. My show isn't about shit talking and gossip. It's about sharing stories from my life, some of which involve other people that people are very familiar with. I mean, if you've read my books, then you might even be familiar with some of these stories, but the spoken story is much different than reading it in the book, regardless if you know the outcome or not. And so there are other people involved, but generally those people they look pretty good. I'm the one who looks like an idiot. But I'm not a shit talker, really. So that's not what this is all about. I'm not on stage to do that to other people. And sure, I have answers to those questions, but it's not necessarily there for me to share that in a public forum. So, you know, because like I said, it's not a shit talking show. It's not a reality show. It's not Twitter. I'm not up there to just talk a bunch of crap. That's not what it's about.
Right. So if people ask you a question like that, you've got no fear in just saying, yeah, you know, we're not going to answer that question. Move on.
Well, I'll probably have something really smart and cutting to say back to them to make them feel dumb for asking me that.
Okay.
So watch what you ask me, people.
Oh, see, now I'm very curious. Can I ask you a dumb question and get the retort?
Let's see. Like I said, it depends how surly I'm feeling. Now I'm extremely jet-lagged, so I feel like my edge is really dull.
Oh, no. Okay. All right. So how about politics? If people ask you about politics or things that, you know, that are happening in the world, are you a Trump supporter, that sort of thing?
People could, like I said, people could ask me whatever they want.
Mm-hmm. So, Scott, it sounds like you are embarking on this very interesting trip here in Australia, and I hope the Aussies are kind to you. God knows they used to kick the shit out of me when I went on stage. So, I think you'll do fine, though. Look, Scott's going to be in Adelaide on Monday, September 24th. That's today, if you're listening to the podcast the day it comes out. Wednesday in Melbourne. Saturday, the 29th, at the Metro in Sydney. That should be a fun show. And then Monday, October 1st, back in Brisbane. And tickets are... I tell you what, you know, I've got a link at the Vinyl Guide on Facebook. You can go there, and there's some links where you can get tickets, and there's a bit of a Vinyl Guide discount code if you want to get in and see the one-man riot, Scott Ian. And make sure to go to scott-ian.com. You can check him out, his books. He's got I'm the Man, which is his autobiography, which is a hilarious book. It's quite awesome. You've also got the new Access All Areas Stories from a Hard Rock Life. That book just came out as well, so check that out. And you can also pick up Scott Ian action figures, which looks exactly like him, complete with his beard. And by the way, it does come with conditioner that you could run through with a little toy comb. So
that's only in the limited edition.
Yes, you have to get the special edition, and
with actual hair from my chin.
Oh yeah, you're really selling it now. All right, thank you so much for joining us today, Scott.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
On this very Anthrax-heavy episode of the Vinyl Guide, we also have on the line here a friend of the show, my personal friend as well, Sean Franklin. And Sean, as you know, is a remastering genius. He works with all sorts of different bands on looking across their back catalog, getting the tape, sifting through the demos, the alternative tracks, that sort of thing, and packaging these beautiful remasters of some of their finest work. He's been working with Anthrax and just completed the 30-year anniversary of the Anthrax State of Euphoria LP. So are you excited about this remaster? How did it go?
Well, first of all, I'm extremely excited. I personally feel that this is my best work. I think it's the best thing that I've ever done. This release took so much time and so much energy to put together, but I really feel like it's just like one big, like, cohesive piece. It's almost like the Beatles anthology set, because I had a stack of tapes that Charlie sent me to go through, and like, in going, like, it could be like one 90-minute tape of nothing but him in front of like a TV watching Married with Children or something, just like an acoustic guitar just riffing out for like 45 minutes aside. And all of a sudden I find one little nugget, which is one of the riffs from like one of the songs from State of Euphoria. So we use that. It's like Charlie humming into a boombox, or the band in the rehearsal studio, or just whatever. It's just like, there's just so much. I made these little mini sweeps, I call them. So like, if you take like the first song on the album, Be Your End All, it'll be like, you know, like I mentioned, Charlie humming into the boombox, into the acoustic guitar with Married with Children, to them in the rehearsal studio, to them tracking, to an alternate mix. It's like these big, long, like 10, 11 minute tracks for each song. It's just, I don't know, it's wild. It's awesome.
Oh, so you're actually kind of tracking the whole history of the song, it sounds like, from the very genesis, from the time it pops into his idea, you Peg Bundy inspires him to, you know, do something. So he's writing some of these songs, they come together, you get the rehearsal tapes, you start piecing those together, and then all of a sudden the end result is one of the tracks on the album. Am I understanding that right?
Yeah. I mean, not for every song. I tried to do that for every song, but like, I think finally, if I remember correctly, I think it's just like that. Like for that song, it was just Charlie tracking the drums. So you'll have like the drum track, and then like on the right hand speaker, you'll have like a low mix of Scott's guitar, because they tracked them together. But the thing is, like what I thought was so fascinating, like for that song, for example, is like the end of the song, the double basses are just like completely like ludicrous. Mm-hmm. They're so fast, and just to have it almost like isolated, I thought was like a really interesting listen. Because I mean, Charlie's not like, it's not like Charlie Watts, or I mean, it's not just like pretty straightforward. I mean, I always loved his drumming, and it was like, it was just so cool. Like you could always like listen, and it's like, besides the double basses, like his little accents with ice bells and stuff like that. And I always loved how he had two sets of hi-hats. Like, you can always hear, like, when it goes from like a bridge to a chorus, he'll switch hi-hats. And I don't know. I could always just like watch this guy and listen to this guy drum like all day long. So I'm like, I don't know, to have it isolated, I was like, well, this is really unique. This is pretty cool.
Yeah, Charlie's a really tasteful drummer. You know, I mean, in the whole heavy metal genre, there's a lot of times where the drummers, they're talented, they're good, but Charlie just has that extra pizzazz to him. And so that's interesting. So are we going to actually hear on the set the isolated drums?
Yes.
Oh, for how many songs?
Yep. Probably like three of them.
Wow.
Possibly. I did not master this, and I'm not mastering these re-releases. Like, I didn't do Spreading the Disease. It's a guy named Paul Logos. I'm doing all the compiling, editing, picking out the takes, the tracks, and everything, and then submitting everything to Charlie. Like, I'm basically putting the whole package together, submitting it to Charlie for his approval, and then we make corrections or whatever, and then it goes to the guy Paul Logos, because they were using Paul before I even stepped into the picture. So it was just, right. It became like a thing where it's like, okay, well, we'll have you do all this, and then we'll have him do this. So it was like, everyone's happy.
Yeah. Your production, really. I mean, you're kind of going through it, and you're identifying the different bits and how they fit together and constructing things. And of course he has final say on it, but you know, you're orchestrating a lot of this, it sounds like.
Well, yeah. But again, it's not like I'm running the show. Mm. It's just like, I'm like, as a hardcore fan, I'm like, hey, listen, Charlie, I found this, blah, 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 blah. What do you think of this? We should use this. So it's very interactive thing. It's not like, you know, I put the whole thing together and like, you know, here we go, this is what we're going to do.
Right.
But with all that being said, it's exciting, is, you know, it's exciting because I never know what nuggets I'm going to find. And then when we actually find something, it's like, oh, wow, check this out. This is awesome. And then, like I said, once we establish the bits and everything, and then I put it all together, yeah, I mean, I shave things off, do this. And like you said, I'll submit the final project to him. And then once he signs off, then we're good to go. Mm. So, yeah, I mean, I am picking out a lot of things. I totally appreciate and I'm totally, grateful to Charlie for like all these opportunities and everything. Mm. So I think we have a really cool working relationship.
So it sounds like you've gone through a lot of effort, dozens, if not hundreds of tapes, listening to them, picking out bits, constructing what you think this the end state of this box set would look like. What is actually going to go onto vinyl?
It's double vinyl. I know that. I mean, you can go to Amazon, you can see it double vinyl, but I thought some of the extras are actually going on the vinyl, but no, it's going to be like, I think it's the actual album remastered for vinyl on 45 RPM or whatever, because it's two records. But again, I haven't seen the final result, so I'm not totally sure.
Okay. So some of the extra tracks may not have made it to vinyling. And quite honestly, look, if they're outtakes, having all of those things probably on digital is fine.
Oh, yeah, I think so.
So the Anthrax State of Euphoria reissue comes out October 19th, and it's a big day. You'll finally have one in your hands, and people here can order them off Amazon, or I'm sure anthrax.com will have that as well. What's the next project?
Well, for them, we're going to do Persistence of Time.
Yeah.
Now, that one, well, like I mentioned previously, I'm like, as of this point, State Euphoria, to me, is my finest achievement. And I'm like, oh, how am I going to top that? But then again, looking ahead, Persistence is even more crazy because there's way more tapes in the archive for Persistence. So Lord only knows what I'm going to find, because I've only scratched the surface, even just like, seeing some of this stuff. Because, I think you and I have talked previously, I think I mentioned that, like, a lot of the tapes will say, like, Anthrax, new stuff, and that's it. There's no titles on the J-card for the tape. There's no nothing. I have no idea what it is. So it's almost like, sometimes you find gold, and sometimes it could be, like, just one song, like, one mix of a song. Like for example, there is a mix of Milk from the SOD song, mm-hmm. from Attack of the Killer Bees.
Yep.
And it's got like actually has like bee sounds on it, like, like obviously that's not on the record, but okay. Like that'll be like that's like the only song on the whole entire tape. So you never know what you're gonna find. So
and you got to go to Charlie and go, what the hell is this? What were you guys thinking? And it kind of jogs his memory.
Oh, it's just funny because like I'm trying to get a grasp of what happened for Persistence, because there's one tape from Conway Studios and I think it's Hollywood, and I was like, well, so I'm like, did you guys do a lot of like pre-production in your studio in New York, or like what's this Conway Studios? And I didn't realize that's where they did a lot of like demoing and stuff like that for Persistence. And I've got like them doing Jailbreak from Thin Lizzy and stuff like that. So I think we're going to try to include that for Persistence.
Far out. Now, are you finding the deeper you go into the Anthrax catalog, the more tapes there are? It doesn't sound like there was that much stuff to go through with Spreading the Disease, but there was a heap of stuff to go through for State of Euphoria. And then Persistence sounds like even more. Is that the trend?
Absolutely. Because with Spreading, so the main tape from Spreading that was very, very important that like Charlie couldn't find. And then after he sent me a gigantic box of stuff, he found the tape. Basically, it was like it was Joey's first recording with the band in the studio, because if you recall, they pretty much had Spreading already recorded, and they had a singer at the time. I think Matt Fallon. I can't remember who it was, but anyway. And then Joey, auditioned for the band, but it was basically his audition, and it was Medusa with the first vocal pass with him, and Charlie found that. So we were like, oh, that's awesome, let's use that. And then I couldn't even believe, then all of a sudden it's like pretty much like the whole entire Spreading album instrumental is on that tape too. So we used a ton of that stuff for the reissue. So that tape was very important. But there was only a few tapes Spreading wise. And then, I mean, Among the Living, there was some stuff, but the thing is Among the Living Deluxe was already done before I came in. So obviously we're not doing that. And then when I started, when I started going through stuff, it was like the State stuff. I was like, oh my God, there's a lot of stuff here. This is cool. I've got my own self-challenge. I'm trying to outdo myself from state to persistence.
Well, that is awesome. And I wish you luck for the next several months of listening to tapes and demos for Persistence of Time, and evenings where Charlie is sitting in front of Married with Children or the Rockford Files and noodling on his guitar. And Sean, thanks so much for coming on the show. Real quick, what is happening with you next? What stuff are you doing, Anthrax or non-Anthrax? You got a lot of stuff happening right now, yeah?
Oh, you better believe it. My schedule is jam-packed, like no tomorrow. I mean, I'm literally up at 3:20 a.m., like 5 to 6 days a week. One of the biggest things that I'm really excited about is I'm producing segments called This Day in Hip Hop History for Chuck D for his on one of his programs on rapstation.com. I just did DJ Lord from Public Enemy's new EP, mm-hmm. which has Chuck D and then Kool Keith is on there. That's really smoking. I love that. No, just all kinds of projects.
That is brilliant. So hopefully soon you'll be able to make some time for the Scallions, which, you know, we love
over
here.
I would love, I miss that so much. I mean, I just had this conversation with my friend Mike, and it's like, I really do. I miss the Scallions so much. It's just, it's a scheduling thing, I think, above anything. I mean, it's not like, I mean, I almost talk to my brother, like, pretty much almost every day. So, I mean, it's not like, you know, we're kind of like distant and stuff like that. It's just,
you're not like Ray and Dave Davies or anything like that. There's no
no,
you're not the Gallagher brothers punching each other up. Okay.
Oh, no way. But the problem is he lives like an hour away from me, and it's like he doesn't get home till like 6 o'clock, and again I'm in bed by like 7:30, 8 o'clock every night. So it's really hard. Well, but I miss it. I do love that stuff.
Well, look, Sean, I don't mean to hold you back anymore. I know you got a ton of stuff to do, so I'm going to let you go. Again, thanks again for coming on the show, and I want to remind everyone, the Anthrax State of Euphoria Remastered Deluxe Edition is available at anthrax.com. Of course, try to buy it from your local record shop before you go over to Amazon. You got to support your local shops as much as you can, or buy direct from the band. They could use the cash as well. Jeff Bezos, he has plenty of cash, so use Amazon as a last result. Sean, thank you so much, man, and we're keen to have you back on when your next project's done.
Oh, one last thing. Again, I don't have a copy in my hand, but it appears there's a limited press on vinyl. I think like one of the records is red, one's yellow, and then there's a standard black issue. So there is two versions.
There's a deluxe limited edition colored vinyl. Any idea what the numbers are on that?
I don't know.
Okay. All right, I'm clicking online right now. State of Euphoria 2LP 30th edition limited edition colored vinyl. It's a red and yellow. That's $45, and then the standard black version looks like the same thing, only black vinyl, $23.98. That's available at anthrax.com. All right. Thanks, Heap, Sean. Take care. We'll see you soon, man.
All right, my man.
Right, there it was, an Anthrax doubleheader, Scott Ian and Sean Franklin. Thanks, guys, for coming on the show. By the way, everyone, I just confirmed the vinyl version of the State of Euphoria reissue does come with extra tracks on the vinyl. Sides 1 through 3 are the album remastered. Side 4 is full of bonus material, live tracks, that sort of thing. So you could check it out and order your limited edition colored vinyl version or the regular black vinyl version at anthrax.com. Oh, well, there we go. That is this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. Please leave us positive reviews on iTunes or Google Play or wherever you get this show from. It really helps us grow the Vinyl Guide community. Lets me know how I'm doing as well. Feel free to shoot me an email anytime, nate@thevinylguide.com. And, of course, we've got like 130, 140 additional episodes in our backlog. You can always listen to them at thevinylguide.com. Alrighty, I'm planning on being back next week, so until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.